Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on September 21st, 2019. This class is class 9 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, Introspective Insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Today's the ninth class of 32 classes on our structured study of Vipassana, Introspective Insight into the Three Marks of Existence. And this is the insight that the Buddha teaches is to develop through the Eightfold Path, and really no other insight. And the reason why I'm saying that is it's very specific, the Buddha's Dhamma. It's focus on this one thing, to resolving the problem of ignorance manifesting in the world due to clinging to fabricated views of that, of the world, I'm going to say of ignorance. And as we learned a few weeks ago on dependent origination, I think it's the sixth and seventh conditions in there, from craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining comes becoming. There's never a qualifier or a modifier to becoming. And a lot of misunderstanding grew out of that, but it simply needs to be seen in the context. So in the context of dependent origination, what the Buddha awakened to, if we continue to use as a reference point and a framework for the way we think in relation to the world, if that reference point and framework is still rooted in ignorance, one can only become further ignorant. That makes sense to everyone? And again, we're not talking about an ignorance like we're incapable of knowing what a doorknob is. In the context, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's the only thing that Buddha was concerned about. So we shouldn't take offense that we're ignorant of it, because nobody ever taught us it. We're not, you know, it's not something we're taught in kindergarten, although it could be. So if our reference point and framework for the way we see ourselves in relation to the world is rooted in ignorance, we can only become further ignorant, which means we are maintaining the condition that stress and suffering are rely upon for its arising. In other words, stress and suffering is dependent on the condition, the originating condition of ignorance. That's the teaching on dependent origination, despite what any, you know, what all the modifications that have happened. And that's so singularly significant that if we don't get that one point, that we're dealing, the whole focus is we're dealing with ignorance manifesting within me, our focus is easily distracted towards other ideologies, other theories, other mystical practices. It's just this one thing. And that's the whole point of this 32 class series. Why are you laughing at that?
We could just stop. We could all go home now.
That's a good idea.
32 hours to tell us.
Well, you could say that every Dhamma teaching is focused on this. Anyway, putting aside that distraction, I'm just kidding. And so then the choice is, if I interrupt that process rooted in ignorance of simply becoming further ignorant, and I develop the Eightfold Path, then I now have the opportunity and the potential to become awakened. And it is at this nexus point, what am I going to become? In this moment is where the Dhamma is practiced. A mind united in its body is where the only place the Dhamma can be practiced. And if I'm mindful of right view and the entire Eightfold Path, then in this moment I can become, or at least incline my mind toward becoming, further awakened. That's the immediacy of the Dhamma also. You'll notice, I might not get to the Mula Sutta. In the second sutta, the Bhava Sutta, the Buddha relates this idea of becoming directly to karma. And I'll explain that further, but it also is a clear teaching on what karma means in the Buddha's Dhamma. So let me continue. Let me begin. The Loka Sutta. Excuse me. The newly awakened Siddhartha, now Buddha, was enjoying the peace of release from ignorant views. Establishing concentration, He observed the world around him. Put yourself back in his place. This is a human being who, through his own efforts, after 6 years of strenuous striving after understanding, finally did awaken. And this is his first impression of the world post his awakening. And also notice how Siddhartha's view of the world now would be a completely accurate view of the world 2,600 years later. The point that I'm making is that the Buddha declared that his Dhamma was a timeless Dhamma, meaning not that it was taught and for going back forever, another misunderstanding, that it's timeless in its application. It's just as relevant today as it was 2,600 years ago, and this kind of shows it right here. He observed the world around him. He noticed human beings aflame with the fires born of the defilements of passion, aversion, and deluded consciousness, deluded thinking. Realizing the significance of what he was seeing, realizing the significance of recognizing the manifestations of ignorance in human beings, ignorance of Four Noble Truths, he had this thought. The world is aflame. Rooted in ignorance, the world is afflicted by sensory contact and perceives suffering as self. Does everybody get that?
Perceives suffering as self.
What the Buddha often talked about, the problem of dukkha, is that we as human beings ignorant of Four Noble Truths join with our suffering. Another word for that is self-identify with impermanent phenomena, which is another way of joining with our suffering.
Any identification of self, period, as a solid self would be...
Well, it's more so than that word.
That's an example.
Yes.
That's an example.
In the context of dependent origination, it's because of ignorance of Four Noble Truths that I do cling my self-identity to what's around me, meaning I create a view of myself in relation to the world based on the impermanent phenomena that I'm clinging to and using to describe myself to myself into the world. I know it sounds like incredibly circular thinking, but that's just what it is. It's confused thinking. It's the kind of thinking the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta, of this feedback loop that we get ourselves caught in. All because we're referencing ourselves in the world around us. We're literally creating this mirror-like effect in our view. We can't see anything past that because we're bouncing our views back onto ourselves. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we do that all the time. And so we're not living in reality. We're living in that imagined view. It doesn't mean that what's occurring isn't actually occurring in the physical world, but our experience of it is... our experience of the reality of the moment is obscured by our continued compulsive need to ignore what's right in front of us. That's ignorance. It's the nature of ignorance to ignore, to continue itself through continued ignorance, to ignore its own ignorance. Is that clear? And that's that point of becoming that we're talking about. It's only in this moment that I can recognize and abandon my own ignorance by, in this moment, developing wisdom, meaning integrating the Eightfold Path. Rooted in ignorance, it misunderstands self and becomes anything other than self. This is going to take me a while to get through, as you can see. What does it mean? It means that in this moment, because I have a fabricated, false, ignorant view of who I am in relation to the world, what else can I do but create something other than what I truly am? And if I'm living a life clinging to a belief of what I am that's rooted in ignorance, what's my life going to be like?
Stressful,
suffering, confusing, always grasping after what? Ultimately, it's grasping after understanding.
Surprising.
But it doesn't know it because it's established itself in objects. And there's no understanding in objects, is there? And it can be as simple as... I decided I like red Ferraris, and so I'm only going to be happy if I continue to buy a new red Ferrari every year. If we create an identity over that, look at the stresses that's in that. But we do that with the most subtle things, and that's where the real problem is. It's not because of grand ideological clinging. It's the little things that we cling to that we make self-identities over that are so difficult to see and so debilitating as we continue to carry on with them.
It's also surprising because you've created this fabricated self that when suffering hits you in the face, you're not ready for it. So this illusion is popped, and then to the day you die, you're a little bit stunned by the reality.
Yeah, that's right. We're stunned. How did this happen? How could this happen to me? Rather than realizing dukkha occurs, there's nothing personal about it. But look at where this teaching comes in the Buddha's overall dispensation. What he realized upon his awakening, and this is the Buddha's not a savior. In other words, he's not an all-knowing God that's saying, "This is what you've people done to yourselves." He did it. He knows he did this to himself too. He'd looked out on the world and realized that people are becoming anything other than what they are, authentic human beings. In a few weeks, we're going to get to the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, where the Buddha describes the four physical elements, earth, wind, fire, and water, the sixth property of space, where that can manifest within, and the sixth property of consciousness, ongoing thinking. Whatever that thinking is rooted in it is going to determine what we become. And so that is what a human being is and can never be anything more than that. And there's a lot of freedom in understanding that. The Buddha continues, becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming. And again, it's going to take a long time to get through this. Every line is so important. Cling to anything other than becoming. Once I've decided what I am and what I need to be happy, safe, and secure in this world, even though it's rooted in ignorance, I am compelled to cling to it. Because I've now decided this is who I am. And what is the underlying motivation for each and every human being? Self-preservation. We do some many foolish things to do that, but there are some things that we need to do that are obscured. The most necessary things are obscured because of the cloud of ignorance that we've included in our own way of thinking.
So, John, I would just can I offer also just taking it back to like each moment, anytime like I'm sitting listening, right, and there's a pleasant sensation that occurs, and there's this little that wants to hold on to that. So, because it's this ignorant piece has identified with that's what I need to keep myself okay.
Yeah.
So it's not even the big Ferrari, like you said. It's these very subtle movements of just keeping thinking that this is who, what I am, and this is what I need in this moment.
And so what you're describing, the subtle things, my comfortable chair that I can't do without. Again, that sounds silly, but the underlying motivation for that is not the comfortable chair, it's the comfortable thought.
Sure.
And that's what we cling to. And we, excuse me, we cling to these thoughts, even if they've caused great difficulty in our lives, because they're familiar, because we created it. And we think that there's refuge in our thoughts when the true refuge lies in release from those thoughts. It's another important teaching on the triple refuge. So we talked about external objects, Ferraris and easy chairs, but the underlying motivation for all of those, that type of clinging, is ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Developing the wisdom of Four Noble Truths release our minds from joining with our suffering as the sutta started.
Joining with our suffering is joining with what is a pleasant sensation that we want to hold on to.
Here, this is the next line. Becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming, is afflicted by becoming, and yet delights in that very becoming. The thing that is most debilitating with us, because of self-referential views, we delight in it, even when it's directly causing misery in our lives. Let me continue, because there's a clarification for that that's really remarkable. Where there is delight, this is what I mean, where there is delight, there is fear. Mm-hmm. Does everybody get that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Why? Yeah. I always put you on the spot. I'm going to ask somebody. I'm going to ask Anthony, because I always put you on the spot.
Because it could end.
Mm-hmm. That's it. And that is
there's no me left.
That is an aversion to the underlying, one of the underlying aspects, impermanence. We cling ourselves in a permanent way to things that are entirely impermanent. And ultimately, this results in clinging to views that we insist are impermanent or want to be. We insist are permanent, even though thoughts are just like other things. They're just as fleeting, which also points to how we can find release because our thoughts are fleeting. We're not locked into it. No matter how hard we're clinging, how tenaciously we're clinging to our views, all we have to do is recognize and abandon them, and poof, they're gone. It's not the reason why I'm saying it doesn't not necessarily have to be a long analytical struggle, but it does take this framework.
John.
Yes, Tim.
It's not so much the delight. I know it's what it says in the sutta, it's the desire. Because if you
I don't mean to interrupt you.
Yep.
Desire is delight, it's the same thing. You know, we delight in the things that when our desire is fulfilled, we are delighted by it.
Right, I don't want to get caught in minutia of that, but if something like you had said before, of sensual base that feels good, if you recognize that it feels good, that it will not last forever, that it will be fleeting,
And
you will not cling to it, then there will be no suffering and pain to it. And so that line kind of made me just think that it's not so much the, I don't want to mix up words.
Well,
desire would have, I thought, makes more sense.
Again, look at the context.
Yeah.
And in this sutta, what the Buddha's talking about is that motivating, grasping after delightful experiences. And where there is delight, and the fulfillment of delight is really what we're talking about. There's always fear, at least the next line. And so where there is fear, there is stress. So again, there's so much in the sutta. Grasping after something that we feel we need to be, whatever it is, to be a whole human being, has its own inherent stress. And even the acquisition of that object of desire then has its own form of stress, doesn't it? And so all we're doing is continuing this cycle rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And Tim brought up an important point. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't enjoy our lives. In fact, it leads to a way of living in the life where every single moment is enjoyable because we don't need it to be any different. And there's a remarkable vibrancy and poignancy to being in our life as our life unfolds that cannot be experienced any other way. It's very subtle, but it's what we are. It's how we're meant to live in this world. And that's what the Buddha awakened to.
And to use the Buddha as the example, one of the refuges, he had a equal poise to aversion, to desire, to neutral. There was he didn't react in a way where he was aware of it, but then he understood that it would pass. So that's the example.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And why didn't he react?
Because he was unbound.
He didn't need things to be any different than they are.
So that's the example. I mean, more and more, it's keep going back to what this whole 32 class hours is pointing to is the three marks. And then the example
whole point
that the Buddha gives us in each and every sutta. And there's a serenity, the equal poise, as an example.
Thank you. That's exactly how the Buddha describes the culmination of his path as well. We don't take anything personal. And because of that, our minds stay calm and at peace, no matter what's occurring. And to some, that might not even sound like a worthwhile goal, that I want more out of life than just a calm and peaceful mind. If that's what you want, that's a true example of ignorance, isn't it? Why would you want more than a calm and peaceful mind?
Because
that's why we're doing all these other things.
Mind.
We're spending our lives trying to acquire things, not just physical things, acquire an ideology that fits, that allows us to be calm and peaceful, but it doesn't work because we're always grasping, going back to dependent origination, initiating in always craving after or desire that can only lead to fear, and fear leads to stress. So again, I'm trying to weave this sutta into showing you that this manifests within individuals. So everybody's getting that?
Yes.
We're doing this to ourselves. It's not something that is happening from, it's not something being imposed on us. It's not because we're bad or we're wrong or we're lacking. We're simply not seeing things clearly. Continue. Yes.
What you're describing, but when we're always seeking to be comfortable, etc. I mean, when our minds have the opportunity to be calm and relaxed, they often aren't, because we create our own arising, another arising, mm-hmm. and passing.
Yes.
Whether it's going into the future, and it's holding your mind in that calm and peaceful state, which is really difficult. So how does the arisings that we have in our mind dovetail into what you're talking about this morning?
Wow, good question. So taking it back to dependent origination, that part of where it says clinging and maintaining comes becoming, mm-hmm. that's just what you're describing. Mm-hmm. The views that we're clinging to and maintaining through that clinging, those are two components of maintaining what's rooted in ignorance. Clinging for it and then maintaining it is just what you're describing. Because of clinging to wrong views, views ignorant of Four Noble Truths, and not in the moment recognizing that what's arising is rooted in that ignorance, it creates that reaction of clinging to it. But every time we recognize it, and so I know you've learned this before, in this moment when we can recognize clinging arising through seeing that, mm-hmm. seeing that process, and just simply recognizing that that is not me. And we're so close to that, that's why it's so hard to see, mm-hmm. because it's us. We've created this veil of ignorance that the Buddha created an Eightfold Path to pierce, but that doesn't mean that when we're stuck in it, we can see clearly. We can't yet. That's why we need a framework of an Eightfold Path. If it wasn't so, if all that we needed to hear was you were rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, here they are, read them, because anybody can read them and understand them, we would simply just do that and awaken, wouldn't we? But we can't, because we have this thing called ignorance. Ignorance compels further ignorance. It's related to this talk on becoming. In this moment, when those manifestations of ignorance arise, what am I going to become?
More ignorant.
Am I going to continue with those views by reacting to them in some way? Or am I going to recognize there's no me here? This is just a fabrication. Let it go. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And the difficult thing for a self-referential ego self is to leave it right there. Because even within the framework of often within the framework of the Dhamma practice, we can do that part of it, recognizing a manifestation of ignorance. But because of this need to obscure ourselves from our own ignorance, ignore our own ignorance, we'll simply carry that wrong view into the possibility of right view in this moment. In other words, we'll continue to obscure our own ignorance by falling back to a familiar view. But that's just Dhamma practice. That's not wrong. It doesn't mean we're not doing it. That's the reason why there's a process. You first have to recognize what you need to let go of, and then you can let go of it. But it doesn't mean that for most of us it's going to be immediate. For some it was. You know, for Kandana it was. But not for most of us. We're more like Ananda, the Buddha's cousin. It took him a little bit longer than just a few lessons, you know, a few teachings. Did that answer your question?
Perfect. Yeah.
Thank you. All right, let me get through this. Yes.
Is it like if you have unskillful views of yourself or something like that, you pop up and arise, and then I guess, you know, fear of letting those go because, you know, think something could be different. So this could apply in that same category.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
is what you're describing, I guess.
Yep. Yep. That's it.
That's it.
Thank you. Let me get back to it. Where there is fear, there is stress. I'm going to skip over my comments. The Buddha continues, the life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming. And of course, the qualifier in the context of becoming further ignorant. The life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived, I can put in here, for the sole purpose of abandoning of becoming further ignorant. It's the entire Dhamma, or the entire instructions towards the Dhamma. The Buddha continues, those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming are never released from becoming, I declare. The Buddha even adds that in there. It's a very important statement. Does everybody know what that means? Those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming are never released from becoming. What does it mean?
Well, they're just chasing the, they're still chasing the something.
Yes, and what, what's a direct reference to non-becoming? Sorry, Jen.
The direct reference to non-becoming, I know it's anything not this, but in my brain, it's anything. I mean, if you're, it doesn't matter if you're trying to become or trying to not become, you're still trying to do something.
Yeah,
and you're fabricating into the future.
And what are we trying to become? Anything other than self.
Right.
That's non-becoming. And then in a very specific way, and it's related in many of the mystical teachings of non-becoming also refers to grasping after a speculative non-physical establishment, such as a future non-physical life that we get rewarded for all the good deeds we've done or punished for the bad deeds we've done. Those are all non-becoming. And it's never in our human life as our human life unfolds, is it?
That's easier.
Well, it's the perfect escape, isn't it? So again, and the perfect escape from what? In a abstract way, an escape from my life, but in a true way, it's an escape from the realities of my life, and that's why we do it.
It's an escape from dealing with the ignorance, which is your conditioned thinking.
And it works perfectly well, doesn't it?
It's the work. It's the Eightfold Path.
Yes. So if I can apply beliefs and ideologies such as continued bowing will resolve all the things that are wrong with me, according to the Buddha, it's not going to work. Chanting, different types of so-called meditation practices, beliefs in gaining merit by good deeds that will be rewarded in some future lifetime, that's all what the Buddha is referencing here in non-becoming. And there are so many suttas where the Buddha references this single point in different ways and always cautioning against falling into the fabricated view of creating a self in a non-physical way. Even if it's just in our imagination, such as, if I do this particular practice long enough, we leave this part out when we're thinking about it ourselves, I imagine that I can be whatever, an awakened person or whatever it might be. That's all in our imagination, isn't it? There's no way to experience it because we're holding the carrot on our own stick. It's always in front of us. It's always an acquisition rather than just resolve. There's nothing to non-become, is there? And why would I want to? But it's what we do often in so-called spiritual practices. We're always grasping after being something that we can never be. Because it's just in our imagination, ultimately.
And in the Buddhist time, they were sacrificing animals and people and
still,
all kinds of, you know, very brutal activities.
Well, we still do that as human beings. Becoming. We still have severe ascetic practices that the Buddha talks about.
That's fine. I'm saying, and in his time, right, it was a pretty brutal time.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, there's parallels now, man.
Well, yeah, the Buddha was teaching, thank you for bringing it up, the Buddha was teaching how to live in a practical way during the conditions of his time, too, which are very similar to today's. Those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming or never released from becoming, I declare. Stress or dukkha arises in dependence on becoming self. But again, in the context of becoming a self rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. With the ending of clinging to self and maintaining self, no stress will arise. Clear and direct instruction on how to end this. Look at the world. Human beings afflicted with ignorance crave for and cling to becoming. Excuse me. Another significant aspect of this particular small sutta is just this. Notice the focus. It's not on external conditions. It's not on seeking salvation. It's directed precisely at the way we think about ourselves in relation to the world. All forms of becoming, anywhere, in any way, are impermanent, stressful, and always subject to change. Knowing this, the arising and the passing away, From right view, craving for becoming and for non-becoming is simply abandoned. Skip over some comments. From the abandonment of craving for becoming and non-becoming comes unbinding. Unbinding from what? Unbinding from those views that are maintaining ignorance of Four Noble Truths. For those unbound from lack of clinging and maintaining, there is no further becoming, no more further becoming ignorant. Now there's the possibility to become awakened. They have conquered ignorance, completed the task, and have gone beyond becoming further ignorant. But you could also add, they have gone beyond becoming anything other than what they truly are. What we truly are, I should say. That's the end of the Loka Sutta. Let me get into the Bhava Sutta. We probably won't get to the Mula, but this is quick. And this sutta relates directly to Ananda's confusion about becoming. And then a very clear teaching on what karma truly means in relation to the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha used the word karma, much like he used anatta and anicca, etc., and dukkha, common words during the Buddha's time, to relate, to meet people where they are. It's the only way to communicate with people. To meet people where they are, using words that they were familiar with, but in a completely uncommon way. And the reason why he did that is because he's using those common words to start turning people away from becoming further ignorant and use their own thinking to become awakened. It's just brilliant.
There's also the whole point in we're so used to having discrete meanings of words.
Yes.
And the language in those days was a lot more diffuse.
Yes.
With words like becoming and birth and karma, you'd almost have to get the flavor of the word instead of the actual definition of it, because you're going to be turning in circles there.
Yes.
And this is why the repetition of the Dhamma is also so important. You just keep hearing this little different shades of the word all the time until you have, like, you can taste it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. That and this is a good, using the word karma is a good example. Most all of you, until you came here, believe that in general, you likely, or it's often, let me say it this way, it's often presented that karma is this grand spiritual system of behavior modification through reward and punishment. Mm-hmm. That's basically what people think. It's not. You leaving, Maura?
Yeah, I'll be right back.
Okay. It's simply not that, but that's the way karma has always been presented, in a slight modification to that. And the Buddha's using that term in a slightly different way. The other thing to understand, that originally the maintenance of the Buddha's teachings was simply through an oral tradition. And there's my article on the website on the Pali Canon explains this, so I won't get into it. But it's a brilliant system, and much more accurate than if individuals were writing it down. I won't get into that. But then between the third and the fourth Buddhist council, it did get written down. And even the way that was maintained is remarkable. But what is most important to me, and it took me a little while to realize this, in order to accurately understand even the most scholarly translations, you have to understand the context, which is why I always talk about that. Because even if outside of that context, I would probably, and most people would, simply try to make my view of karma fit what he's saying, and it doesn't fit. But understanding the overall context of what the Buddha is teaching, then you can interpret even the most scholarly translations in the proper way, which is what this is. So thank you for bringing that up. Let me get going. The Bhava Sutta. On one occasion, Ananda went to the Buddha. Ananda was the Buddha's cousin and his chief attendant for the last 25 years of his life. It is said that Ananda had a word-perfect memory, likely developed through his concentration. It was Ananda and Upala. Upala talked about the Vinaya in the first Buddhist council that recounted, and a few other people, recounted the Buddha's teaching so that they could establish it for posterity. And I won't get too deep into it. So Ananda is a key figure and a cousin of the Buddha. And again, if it wasn't for Ananda, there wouldn't be much Dhamma left because of the way that he took it. But yet, he's even confused. On one occasion, Ananda went to the Buddha, bowed and sat to one side. He wasn't sure of the meaning of becoming, and so asked the Buddha, "Becoming, becoming, to what extent is there becoming?" The Buddha replied, "Ananda, if there were no karma ripening within the feeling property, would the feeling property be noticed?" So maybe confusing words, but the Buddha's immediately pointing to what karma means, action. Even most people will acknowledge that, but they don't know where the action is to be applied to. Karma ripening within a feeling property. What does it mean? It means that the way that I'm feeling is influenced by what I'm thinking, correct? And so the way that I'm thinking is manifesting in the feeling property. So what is karma? Ultimately, karma is the way I'm thinking. Another way of you could describe karma is look in the mirror, because if you want to know what your karma is, look at what you have. It's all up to us. It's all up to what we're grasping after and holding on to is our karma. Again, it's not some grand system of punishment and reward. It's the result of our actions. Another way that I describe karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions, meaning the condition that we've created in our own lives, in our own minds, moderated by the present level of mindfulness. What I'm holding in mind will determine my experience of what's arising in this moment. That's karma.
John, would you just mind reading that last sentence again about the ripening?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ananda, if there were no karma ripening within the feeling property, would the feeling property be noticed? So we'll continue with that. And those that have been on retreat know this is always a part of our retreats. Ananda says, "No, wise teacher, in this way," this is so important, "karma is the field." Take care, Amy.
Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. "Karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture." Karma is the field. It means it's showing that karma is something that is always changing, much like a plant is growing. And we're the ones that are feeding that plant. So how we feed that plant, how we tend to that plant, the karmic field of our life will determine what grows. It's a brilliant metaphor. "In this way, karma is the field, consciousness the seed. What I'm holding in mind is going to produce what's going to grow in this karmic field. And craving is the moisture." Isn't it brilliant?
Mm.
The way I think is going to plant the seeds of my experience in life. And that experience, if it's driven by craving, is what's going to manifest in my karmic field. "Karma is a field, consciousness a seed, and craving the moisture. The consciousness of human beings, rooted in ignorance and bound by craving, is established in a wrong view." Simple, clear, and direct. "Established in wrong view, renewed becoming, further ignorant, is produced. If there is no karma ripening in the form property, would the form feeling or forms, would the form property be noticed?" In other words, the feeling property is noticed, the form property is noticed through self-identification with ignorant views, with impermanent phenomena. And this is where the Dhamma resolves within this form, isn't it? "No, wise teacher, in this way, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. The consciousness of human beings rooted in ignorance and bound by craving is established in wrong view. Established in wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. If there is no karma ripening in the formless property, would the formless property," this is the non-becoming, "would the formless property be noticed, the speculative existences?" No, wise teacher. I'm going to skip over that, the repetition of karma is the field, etc. I thought that was the end of the sutta. I'll leave the Mula Sutta out. It's not important. We made the point. This is a simple and direct teaching on becoming, and including that a correct application of karma. We're going to study karma and rebirth a little bit later on. But this entire sutta points to the immediacy of recognizing, and much like Lorna said earlier, what's arising in our mind now. It has nothing to do with past, with what we've done in the past or what we might have learned in the past or developed in the past or anything. And it has nothing about what we hope to be in the future except hoping, the skillful desire to awaken. And it takes our focus and brings it right into the immediacy of this moment. What am I going to become right now? So we can look back at ourselves and recognize, am I still inflamed with the fires of passion? Am I still grasping after? Am I still craving for a self-referential existence, a self-identifying with impermanent phenomena as a means of keeping myself satisfied because it can't work? Where there's delight, there's fear. Where there's fear, there's stress. It's always there. And we can let all that fear go if we resolve these issues within ourselves and develop a calm and peaceful mind. That's today's talk. Let's go online first and see how Mary's doing. How are you, Mary? Let me go. Wait, I got to unmute your...
Good morning, John.
Ah, there you are. Good morning, Mary. How are you today?
Good morning, everyone. Well, Mary, this was just beautiful, beautiful... I don't want to say stuff because it doesn't do it justice, but suttas to hear. Ever more clear each time I read or hear about it. So, which is very valuable to me in my life. So thank you, John.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you. Tim, are you on? Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Good morning. I enjoyed the lecture and
You're breaking up a little bit. I didn't hear you, but
I just said I enjoyed the lecture and I don't have anything else to add.
I'm glad you joined us. Give me a call later today or tomorrow, right?
Okay.
Right, thanks.
Everyone's in the room.
Good morning, Jen.
I'm a chicken processing plant. I'm not very Buddhist.
So the last sutta. Is it saying that form or like awareness of form, feeling, thoughts goes unnoticed when you're not?
Yes, that it's the essence of ignorance, isn't it?
Or noticing them is the essence of ignorance.
Noticing the inner process that I'm using my feelings rooted in ignorance to validate now my experience. Karma is the result of the actions, meaning not just physical actions, mental actions, manifesting in this moment. Karma is a field. So that self-referential reference that is using feelings rooted in, manifested from fabricated views, validating my current experience, the feeling property, is only continuing my experience of ignorance. I can only become further ignorant. And the same thing with the form, that now I've self-identified with this form. I'm making this personal. And once I've done that, what's happening to this formless property through my reaction is simply continuing my conditioned views.
So the feeling property may arise within us, but if we're in right mindfulness, then it won't ripen because we won't be identifying with it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
The form property or the feeling property or the thoughts.
Yes. Calling it
non-becoming. I always have a hard time with that one. Non-becoming. What is it?
Well, non-becoming
property. Feeling property, and then there was not something about non-becoming.
Property. The formless property.
Formless property.
That's the non-becoming property.
Right. Okay.
And again, that's.
Which is like.
Even though it's truly imagination, it's made real and actually made physical because of the construct that we've given it within our own minds. It's just a belief system, but because we believe it, it's now real, and that is.
Right.
You know, that's the other important thing to recognize about our own minds. We can create anything we want. And when we do that and believe that it's us, there's the problem. Because it is now real. And so when I acquire the belief, no matter whatever the means are, whether it's through a teaching or a philosophy or just living in the world and hearing things, that if I jump on a pogo stick 300 times in 2 days, in 17,000 years, I'll go to pogo heaven. And I believe it. What am I going to do? I'm going to do 300 pogo sticks. And
now you're distracted.
And now, yeah, now I'm distracted, but I'm also, I'm completely distracted away from finding a Dhamma that might actually save my thinking, because I believe in this. And again, that's really the practical way the Buddha is teaching. Get rid of the pogo stick. This is the second week I've made a reference to a pogo stick, isn't it? So get rid of the pogo stick and practice the Dhamma. And forget about taking direction or keys from how you feel in your body, because they're rooted in the wrong view. You can't trust, you literally can't trust your thinking until it's framed this way.
But the form properties, well, if the form property arises, don't cling to it.
Yes.
Or the direction behind this.
Yes, and how does a form property arise? It's simple. It says, I'm in the world and I'm reacting to the world because I'm taking it personal. This is anatta, this is self, and this is where it resolves. And when this physical property starts imagining itself also as a formless property as salvation, you're double whammied, aren't you? You could say triple whammy by feelings and thoughts, or feelings and form and formlessness. And all of that is rooted in ignorance. And so can only become further ignorant. Did that bring some clarity to that important point?
I still feel like I might be grasping after understanding, but I'm understanding that in an awakened being, the form property will not arise, or it will arise and then it'll pass away. That's where I'm like trying to understand. But maybe that question is confusing.
Well, wait, this is important. It's the form property, my view of form. It's any physical form, but now the focus is on my physical form. Mm-hmm. When my view of this form is just as rooted in ignorance as any other view, then this is a vehicle for further karma.
Okay.
Because of my view. If there is no self-identification, this is how it, if it was read this way, if there's no self-identification with form, then the form is not the problem anymore. If there's no self-identification with feelings,
then it's not noticed.
Then it's not noticed.
Yeah.
Because it's just a feeling. It's just a form.
Okay.
If there's no self-identification with form, I certainly will take care of this form because it's where I reside. In fact, I'll probably take care of it better when I'm more mindful of what's actually occurring.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't self-identify with it. When it's sick, I won't feel bad, like I won't take it personal.
Right.
As I'm aging, I won't lament, I won't regret the fact that I'm no longer 25. It's just where I'm at. When something happens out in the world that is awful, I'll just recognize it as dukkha and act accordingly instead of reacting, whatever it might be.
Right.
And again, this is all resolving within us. Thank you. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, John. Just to continue with that, it's as what we were talking about a few weeks ago in the Buddha's description of nama rupa, this is
name and form.
Name and form, and it goes no further. And I did find an interesting connection in that, you know, throughout these suttas, because that's the delight in further becoming. That's the world as a flame. Once that name and form is established out of consciousness rooted in ignorance, and that ties right to the sutta with consciousness being the field. I also found it kind of unique and not surprising that the dependent origination is 12 links. And if you look, again, not to get into numbers and things, but obviously numbers, there's truth in those. And 3, 6, and 9 are often said to be keys to anything. And the third is name and form, the sixth is feeling, and the ninth is becoming. So it's almost as if it's a 12-sided, crystal. And those three are describing these three suttas, and you can literally jump from name and form to feeling to becoming, and there's a process right there of establishing that nama rupa. So it's interesting to see that all tie in together back into it.
Yeah. Thank you. That's such an important name. Nama Rupa means name and form. It simply means self-identification with form. Mm-hmm. Another widely misunderstood teaching. But that's where it resolves, right there, with that self-identification. So, you know, you could say, are we going to identify ourselves with ignorance or identify ourselves with wisdom? That's really the choice, and that's what can determine what we become. Thank you, Kevin. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning. I really don't know if I fully understood everything that you said, or I really don't know if my head's just blown off. Both is correct. You know, I do understand what you're talking about, but at the same time, it blows your brain,
yeah.
Right? So, and I'm, that's how I feel about today's talk.
Thank you. I'm sorry you blew your head off. These two short suttas, there's so much in there. They're so reflective of many key themes of the Dhamma. I mean, that's why we do it on retreat all the time. But here, it just gets right to the heart of the matter. And even that one line, karma is a field, is something that, you know, from the first time I read it, it just, you know, it rattles around inside my head because it's such clear thinking. Karma is not something that's happening to me. It's the field that I'm growing in my own life. It's up to me what I grow. Thank you. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. One thing that keeps coming up through this course that you've been teaching and I've been reading over the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths and what Buddha became awakened to is the word control. And I know that the Buddha never used that word, but it seems to me that things that are within our control, like the Eightfold Path, okay, those are things that we can control.
Yep.
Anytime we step out of that range of control, we invite the clinging, the desire, the suffering, the ongoing, the becoming, wanting to become something. And to Jen's point, I think that's like a very hard thing to really, maybe never really understand, but the karmic response to a feeling, the beautiful thing about it that I can sense is when we do bring it back within to our control, that literally we can stop. Mm-hmm. And that next moment of karma can be whatever we want it, whatever it will be, based on what we can control in our own life.
Yep. Wow.
That's what I got out of what you were talking about.
You got a lot out of it. The that even that word control, a self-referential ego personality, and ego personality, it's always prone to grasping for more, does not like that word control, does it? Mm-hmm. And that's the essence of the Buddha teaches a way of developing from a completely uncontrolled mind, meaning uncontrolled as far as the Four Noble Truths are concerned, to create a reliable and consistent way of controlling our thoughts and thereby controlling our lives. And what kind of meditation practice would support that? A concentration practice. That's the essence of concentration, isn't it? And from that well-concentrated mind, we can then incorporate the refined mindfulness that holds in mind the Eightfold Path as a framework for living in the world. And it's just like that, just like Tim described. He might have done it better than I did. Thank you, Tim. Good morning, Ram.
Good morning. Boy, my head's still spinning, too.
I'm sorry. I hope it calms down a little bit. Good morning, Maura. Good to see you.
Glad to be here. I think what was, the shorthand route for me is, what was coming up during the talks is mindfulness at the six sense states. And I understand now it's fleshing out, like all the suttas are coming back to the same thing, but establishing mindfulness at the six sense states kind of just like does the work that needs to be done.
Yeah, I think it's, I can't remember the schedule that well, but I think next week we're going to touch on that wise restraint, you know, at the point of contact, because it follows from this. And again, that's what the Buddha's talking about here. You know, karma is that, the field of karma is what's occurring right now.
And then from that arises, the mountains of six and gates arises a tranquil mind. I loved
Kevin.
No.
Anthony?
David, your name was escaping me. But the word equal poise instead of equipoise it was just another way of seeing that. So poise, I see the word of like poise in equipoise, but poised equally. Just gave a really nice flavor to what you were saying, Ram, about words and the tone, the taste, the flavor of something. Yeah. And we know when equal poise is available at the six sense gates, at feelings, at form, you know, with the rising thoughts. So, yeah, that's all I got.
Thank you. Where does the Buddha often use that word poise? And what themes does the Buddha use that? In jhana. That's established in a meditation practice. We develop an inner poise. And also in the teachings on jhana, we're going to do a few of those too. Teachings directly on jhana. That's what we should recognize is developing within us, that inner poise. And again, you think about inner poise, a well-concentrated mind, that framework of the Eightfold Path. That's how we move through life then. With an inner poise. Nothing shakes it. Why? Because we don't take anything personal. It's simply what's arising.
Recognizing tranquility, if you're mindfulness of the sense gates, the further factors of awakening arise.
And they're there to be recognized.
Yeah. So then, which is an equal poise at the end somewhere along the line there. But they flow into each other.
Yes. Thank you.
Jhanic states.
Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning. I'm going to just sit here and enjoy everybody's insights. I feel like everybody here is a teacher today.
They are. Thank you. Good morning, Teacher Dave.
Thank you for your teaching.
Glad you're here. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. Thank you for the sutta. I don't have any comments today.
I'm glad you're here. Good morning, Brett.
Good morning. Thanks for the teaching. It's good to be here. I guess the Dharma just kind of... This simple description of not attaching yourself to the thoughts really clicked in my head this morning. Unskillful thinking. I was having a lot of unskillful thinking and views of myself, and then I was using the fear of letting those go, or the desire, or something, and so that was kind of became really clear, and so it's good to get that. Really see that, so good to be here.
Glad you're here. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Noble silence.
I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, John. At first, I had trouble with the words becoming and non-becoming, but listening to this lecture, reading yesterday, and talking like Michael and I, usually reading, we read together and we talk about it. I think I finally understand it.
Wow.
It's difficult to understand. Sometimes you think, well, becoming is positive, right? It's a positive thing, but not really when you're thinking of it in this manner. Non-becoming and becoming is basically negative because you're rooted in ignorance. And finally, when you finally live to the path of the Eightfold Path and you become... No, wrong word. And you finally are yourself. That self is actually the pure essence, the pure being.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that's why I finally understood. I was like, oh, I understand now. That's because you're pure being. That's yourself. Finally.
Yes, finally is a word.
Life makes you confused. You think you have to become this or that, and that's why. And so I finally said, oh, phew, I finally got it.
That's true vipassana, true introspective insight. That's what we're looking at. What are we going to become? And the incredible freedom and power. I mean, that's up to us. For years, I wanted to become center fielder for the Yankees, and maybe I still want to. Realizing the truth of things, I can
what I want to become, I more or less become. I want to be calm and peaceful. I want to be a mature human being, meaning I want to understand who I am in relation to the world. That's what the Buddha taught. And there's such, again, freedom and power in that. And just being, finally, it was such the perfect word, you know, finally, this is what we are. Great insight. Thank you, John. Good morning, Kevin. Good to see you, my friend.
Thank you for the teaching. And great to be here. That's impossible to follow up. It's just so pure. So thank you. Thanks for the Sangha.
Yeah. Thank you. Always a great class. Again, there is there's so much in these two short suttas, like there are in so many of them. It can seem overwhelming. It might even seem like you'll never get it, but it's just a matter of looking at it and incorporating it, and continuing with this process of learning who we are and learning what we're not. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. It is pretty simple, and it is a very gentle path. You know, I've used to say this more often in the past than I do now, but it's a path of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. Meaning it takes some determination. It takes some skillful determination. It takes kshanti, continued perseverance with the right framework. But we have it. It's all right here. And we've developed it. That's why we're coming here. That's why we're studying these ancient teachings, because they are so incredibly relevant, I think even more so than they ever were. And they work for doing what they want to do. So, great class. our retreat is less than a month now. So if you're coming, please sign up. I hope you do. And I believe Matt has a Qigong class at 10:30.
He does, yeah, today.
Matt, those of you that don't know or haven't been, Matt is, it's just an incredibly fortunate relationship that we have with Matt. This is Matt's business, by the way. But he's an outstanding Qigong instructor. And it's such a nice compliment to what we develop here. And Matt also, that's why Matt comes on our retreats, and he does Qigong there because it just works so well. If you can hang around. What's that?
What is Qigong? So an internal system of Chinese medicine that is built through sort of movement and exercise. That's probably the best way I can sum it, which probably isn't the right way, but...
Yeah, it's a very, very gentle, very determined practice that the essence of the practice is uniting a mind and its body. And then through these, I won't do it justice, but it's a marvelous complement to what we do here. In fact, I would recommend this to more than anything else. If you're going to look, if you're looking for a complementary practice, Qigong is it, especially with a really good teacher. So.
And it develops great sensitivity to what's actually occurring in this fathom-long body.
To feeling. Yeah. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, and
you're
Matt,
in experiencing embodiment.
10:30, you'll find out.
Matt understands.
Feeling arose.
Matt incorporates the Dhamma in his teaching very well. That's why it works.
They're only separate things.
You're already identified.
All right, we'll finish with metta as we always do. The Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding.
By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.